happened then. Along about 1931, Japan took a notion that a piece of China would be very nice for Japan. And Japan went in and took Manchuria, and Japan didn't declare war. Oh no, war was outlawed. But Japan killed just as many Chinamen as if she declared war. And she's still at it. But Japan never has declared war on China because war is outlawed. When Japan signed that treaty. And then Mr. Mussolini decided it would be a fine thing to restore the Roman Empire as Caesar had it way back under. And his first step in that direction was to go down and take Ethiopia. Ethiopia, the oldest nation in the world. And the king of Ethiopia said that he claims that he's descended from King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. I don't know whether that's true or not, but anyway, Ethiopia had been in existence a long, long time. And Ethiopia was a peaceable nation and believed in a pacifist government and they didn't arm in the modern way. And Mr. Mussolini went down there and took Ethiopia. He didn't declare war because war was outlawed. He was abiding by the Nine-Power Treaty, which he'd signed, but he killed just as many Ethiopians as if he had declared war. Ethiopians didn't know the difference. Then Mr. Hitler came along. And Mr. Hitler made up his mind, and if you'll read his book, you'll find what his philosophy of government is, that the power belongs in the hands of the head of the state, and that labor unions have no existence in that country as such. They take their orders from the head of the state. Industry has no existence in that country as such. It takes its orders from the head of the state. This is also true in Italy. Fascism and Nazism and communism work exactly on the same pattern, and the working man is nothing more nor less than a slave in those countries. Mr. Hitler made up his mind that the German Empire ought to be restored as it was immediately after the Roman Empire broke up, and he proceeded to take Austria and Czechoslovakia and Poland. He didn't declare war on those countries. He just went in and took them. And then France and England decided it was time to stop, and they declared war on Mr. Hitler. That's the first war that's been declared since this Nine-Power Treaty was signed, when France and England declared war on Mr. Hitler. And then it suddenly occurred to some of us, and it occurred to the president quite a while ago, that this would be a rather difficult world in which to live if Mr. Stalin and Mr. Hitler and Mr. Mussolini control it. They have no respect for international law or for treaties. They only make treaties to give them time to get force enough to tear them up. And Stalin and Hitler don't even believe in God. And it will be a most difficult world in which to live if those gentlemen control the Eastern Hemisphere. If you suppose that this great nation, the richest nation on earth, the greatest nation that the world has ever seen, the nation that contains more happy people than any other nation in the world in spite of all our troubles, if you suppose that this nation with 80% of the monetary gold of the world, with a production that can't be equaled, while we could feed the whole world and clothe it too. If you think we're going to be allowed smugly to enjoy those good things that those gentlemen control the rest of the world, I think maybe you need an alienist too, as well as that farmer that would go for the Republican Party. Mr. Roosevelt, some 4 years ago, warned the country about the condition that was about to take place in Europe. Nobody believed it. And even after the war started, the statement was made that it was a phony war. Well, I'd be willing to bet my life that Holland and Belgium and Poland and Czechoslovakia and Norway and France don't believe it's a phony war. They've killed more people than ever been killed in the history of any war in the history of the world. And they're at it yet. And civil liberty is only safe in the Western Hemisphere. And if we're going to maintain civil liberty, we've got to be in a position to do it. I don't believe in conscription. I do believe in a universal service to the country that you love. And I believe that universal service may be so outlined that not a single one of the gains we've made in the New Deal will have to be done away with. I believe that if a man's raising food and clothing for the welfare of the country, that is, if he's plowing corn behind a mule, he ought to be given a chance to count that as his service in the national setup. If he's a mechanic in an airplane factory, or a tractor factory, or any other factory that whose output is for the welfare and the defense of the United States, that man ought to be given credit for his service to the federal government. And then I believe that we ought to have the greatest navy in the world, and we're building it. And if it takes 50,000 airplanes to back that navy up, let's build them and man them with 100,000 pilots. We can man them with the best pilots in the world. Now, there isn't a kid in this United States who can't almost automatically drive a tractor. And we have the brightest young men on earth. And then we ought to train enough of these young men with the first line of defense. Our first line of defense ought to consist of just enough to act as a first line of defense and as instructors for a citizen army on the Swiss plan. And then we can meet any situation that may confront the Western Hemisphere, and those thugs who are running the Eastern Hemisphere will understand us when we say, stay out of our backyard. Now, there have been some of us in the United States Senate who've believed in a national preparedness plan for many long years, but every time we get up to talk about it, the fellows who'd outlawed war would cry us down and call us all warmongers. Now, all we want is a plain, common-sense national defense set up to defend the Monroe Doctrine and the United States from attack. We don't want to attack anybody. We don't want any more land. We don't want to take anything away from anybody. In fact, I don't think we're mad at anybody in the world. But that, neither was Holland or Norway or Belgium. They weren't mad at anybody, but that didn't make any difference. Look where they are now. The thing for us to do is to get ourselves in shape so we can meet any emergency that comes along, then we won't have to meet it. Nobody wants to go to war. There isn't a man in the United States Senate who wants to go to war. I've been to one war, and I don't want to see another one. Spent a year in France, and I know what it's like. As I say, some of us have wanted to start a sane national defense program a long time ago. We've just got to the point now where we can start it. And we've started one that I think is sane and as it should be, and it'll be worked out along the plan that I've suggested, I'm very sure. All we want is just common sense defense. I wanted you to know how I felt on that subject. I want you to know how I feel about the National Labor Relations Act. I'm not going to vote to repeal it, for I helped to pass it. I want you to know how I felt with regard to Social Security and regard to the farm program. Those are the four great things that have brought about the emergency that's now facing us. It was on account of those four great things the Democratic Party drafted Franklin D. Roosevelt at Chicago. And I sincerely hope that the people of Missouri will decide to draft the junior senator to go along and help them.
It is always refreshing to be with the Irish, especially on St. Patrick's Day. You members of the Irish Fellowship Club here in Chicago are following the good old Irish custom. You are keeping alive your native pride. Today, the Irish people throughout the world pay homage to the good St. Patrick. Millions of other people, even those who do not follow his faith, have acquired a deep and abiding affection for the kindly saint from Ireland. St. Patrick has become an inspiration to all who know and admire his deeds and devotion. As you probably know, marauders carried Patrick at the age of 16 from his home in what was then Gaul to bondage in Ireland during his 6 years of captivity. While tending the herds of Irish rulers, Patrick experienced a deep religious emotion reflecting his early Christian training. After a daring escape to the continent, Patrick finally returned to Britain with a fervent desire to bring Christianity to the Irish. Despite opposition at home, Patrick went back to Gaul and with a firm determination to prepare himself for his difficult mission to Ireland. Consecrated in the year 432, almost 100 years before the Bishop of Canterbury was created by the Catholic Church, Patrick finally became Bishop of Ireland and began his missionary work where he once suffered the disgrace of slavery. In spreading the faith of his fathers, the good saint condemned slavery, fought racial discrimination, and sought to end the tragic isolation of Ireland from the civilization and culture of the outside world. So many legends have grown up around the patron saint of Ireland that it is rather difficult to distinguish fact from fiction. Although it cannot be proven that St. Patrick actually drove the snakes from the Emerald Isle, we do know that he labored long and hard to expel all evil. In addition to his spiritual teaching, St. Patrick also introduced the learning of the age to Ireland and brought the Irish to the rest of the world. Today, America needs the benevolent aid of another St. Patrick. Evil doctrines of discrimination, frequently imported from gangster nations, plague certain areas in this great country. Racial and religious intolerance is being preached and practiced here by agents of our enemies, as well as by innocent victims of their propaganda. With relentless determination, our deadly opponents still seek to apply the ancient doctrine of divide and rule in their drive for world domination. Unfortunately, propaganda poison is exceedingly difficult to remove from our national bloodstream. The after effects of this poison may be felt for years to come, especially if we do not recognize its danger and actively combat its spread. No nation on earth is more vulnerable to intolerance and bigotry than America, for no nation is composed of so many diverse races and differing creeds as is this land of the free. America became great by being a secure haven for freedom of thought and action. Despite all our shortcomings, we in this country truly present an inspiring example to struggling humanity. We prove conclusively that people of every race and of every creed can dwell together in harmony. Into the plain word American is fused all the ideals, hopes, inspiration, and faith of our people. In fact, America has become the hope and inspiration of all oppressed people throughout the civilized world. Here in Chicago, you sense the ever-increasing, nationwide, heartfelt yearning for a lasting peace. Common sense requires that all Americans should take a good look at modern air maps. By air, no place on the globe is more than 60 hours from your own municipal airport, and this time is steadily decreasing. However, I feel confident that, just as the end of isolation in Ireland in St. Patrick's time was beneficial, so will the new era of international cooperation be a blessing for America and for all the world. No nation on this globe should be more internationally minded than America. Whatever happens in any part of the world personally affects some of us. When Ireland starved, we sympathized and contributed food. When the Germans murdered the Poles and persecuted the Jews, Americans wept for them. When the British bled at Dunkirk, Americans suffered with them. When Russia was overrun by the Nazis and China by the Japs, American hearts were with these unfortunate people. In the light of history, it is not surprising that America has finally assumed world leadership. What other nation has such an intimate understanding of the problems and aspirations of every race? America was built and developed by members of every racial group. Our powerful nation has been welded into one mighty force for freedom by the united efforts of all our people. Our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, indicates one out of many. To me, this refers not merely to the many sovereign states, but also to the members of the many races and creeds who retain their individual integrity, but become Americans all. Today, our heroic fighting men are again making it possible for America to preserve the ideals for which we stand. This war is a crusade. When the cause is just, the Irish simply cannot resist the call to duty. There is something in the makeup of an Irishman which causes him to fight when a dictator attempts to push little people around. The bigger the bully, the better the battle. The more ruthless the opponent, the sweeter the victory. Today, America is engaged in the most ruthless conflict against the biggest bullies in the history of the world. It is victory or defeat We win all or nothing. This means survival or slavery. St. Patrick in Ireland and Abraham Lincoln in America took a forthright position on the question of slavery. They fought for the basic dignity of every human being. They stressed the essential importance of the individual, regardless of race or creed. The world today needs the spiritual guidance of inspired leaders who can rise above creed or class, who can help humanity gain security. If civilization intends to avoid destruction, nations must learn to live together in harmony with each other. International organization can be successful only if all members of the family of nations actually abide by reasonable rules agreed to for the benefit of all. This requires self-restraint and tolerance. If each nation insists upon absolute freedom of action, according to the legal concept of sovereignty, international anarchy becomes inevitable. The recent meeting at Yalta and the coming conference in San Francisco indicate progress along the road to world order. Such an international organization must be created as soon as possible. We dare not postpone building storm shelters until the storm clouds gather. We must not wait for a perfect international plan. Modern wars do not wait while statesmen plan future utopias. We must act and act promptly to check wars before they can get started. As we united for victory, we must unite for peace.
To a greater extent than ever before, our prosperity and security depend upon our natural resources. We are fast becoming a have-not nation with respect to many important minerals. We are short of some basic materials essential to an economy of full production and full employment. We are short of copper, of steel, of lead, and of many other critical materials. We are faced with the danger of a shortage of petroleum products. The United States is now using more oil each day than the entire world used before the war. Shortages of fuel oil have already appeared in parts of the Middle West. A nation is only as strong as its productive capacity. And our capacity is now limited by our shortages. We have laws designed to conserve and develop our natural resources. And these laws, if wisely administered, would largely eliminate our shortages. However, we are now in grave danger that these protecting laws will be made ineffective by the failure of the Congress to provide the money necessary for their administration. We have a long-standing policy that public power resources should be developed for the benefit of the people. As a result of this policy, our country had the means of rapidly expanding our supply of electric power in the early days of the war. These supplies of low-cost hydroelectric power, particularly in the Tennessee Valley and the Pacific Northwest, provided the means by which we were able speedily to increase our production of aluminum and other light metals and to supply the huge amounts of power required for our atomic energy plants. Despite the wartime expansion, however, we face critical shortages in our national supply of power in the next few years. We need more and more electric power to expand old industries, to build new ones, extract minerals from low-grade ores, produce atomic materials for peacetime use, and to expand the electrification of our farms. Our public power program must be carried forward. We must continue to build the multiple-purpose projects that conserve our precious resources and develop low-cost energy. We must build transmission lines and substations and bring power to markets. The hydroelectric power program is vital to the economic welfare of this nation. And in some western states, hydroelectric power is almost the sole resource of available energy. All the great industries of the West, lumbering, agriculture, mining, will be retarded for want of electric power. Nothing must prevent the full development and use of public power in these areas where it is needed most.
Comrades of the 35th Division, ladies and gentlemen, we're here to dedicate this beautiful park to the dead of two world wars whose memory we should always hold dear. The brave men who lost their lives in those wars would approve of the way you have chosen to honor them. This park will be a place of rest and recreation. It is fitting that a war memorial should be something that can be used and enjoyed by the people. Nothing could be more appropriate than to devote a war memorial to those values of human life which our soldiers died to preserve, the values of freedom and peace. We are not a militaristic nation. We do not glorify the military way of life. Some nations have taken greater pride in their military victories than in any other of their national achievements. But it has never been so with this great country. When we think of war, it is with a prayer that the sacrifices our dead have made will never have to be repeated. After every war, we have solemnly resolved to prevent future wars. We've learned, however, that it is not enough to make resolutions. It is not enough to utter them in speeches or engrave them on monuments. We've learned that we must devote the best efforts of our whole nation to make those resolutions come true. We entered the First World War to restore peace and to preserve human freedom. But when that war was finished, we turned aside from the task we had begun. We turned our backs upon the League of Nations, the international organization which was established to maintain peace. We ignored the economic problems of the world and adopted a tariff policy which only made them worse. We let our domestic affairs fall into the hands of selfish interests. We failed to join with others to take the steps which might have prevented a Second World War. This time, we are fully aware of the mistakes that were made in the past. We are on guard against the indifference and isolationism which can only lead to the tragedy of war. This time, we will not let our decisions be made for us by a little group of men who are concerned only with their own special interests. There are some who want to reject the measures that are necessary for defense against aggression. There are some who wish to abandon our efforts toward the revival of world trade. Those are the same voices that misled us in the 1920s. They are misguided by short-run considerations. They refuse to face the plain facts. They try to convince us that we cannot afford to pay the price of peace. But the people of the United States will not be misled a second time. We know that the short-sighted course, the easy way, is not the path to peace. The task is difficult and requires firm determination and steadfast effort. We know that if we are to build a lasting peace in the world, we must achieve three essential conditions. First, this nation must be strong and prosperous. Second, other nations devoted to the cause of peace and freedom must also be strong and prosperous. Third, there must be an international structure capable of adjusting international differences and maintaining peace. The first condition is our own strength and prosperity. It is unusual for this nation to maintain substantial armed forces in time of peace. Yet, so long as there is a threat to the principles of peace, the principles on which the United Nations is founded, we must maintain strong armed forces. Any uncertainty as to the ability or the willingness of the free nations of the world to defend themselves is just an invitation to aggression. We've seen the truth of this statement in the outbreak of two world wars. Our national strength is not, however, simply a matter of weapons and trained men. Even more important are our economic growth and continued prosperity. Our economy is the center of a world economy. The hope of economic revival throughout the world depends in large measure upon the prosperity of the United States. If our production and purchasing power are badly impaired, if the buying and selling and investing that we do in other parts of the world are cut off, other nations will be plunged into chaos and despair. It is a prime belief of the communist philosophy that our kind of economy is doomed to failure. The communists predict that our prosperity will collapse, bringing the rest of the free world down with it. But they're wrong. They're just as wrong as they can be. We must not falter now. We must not defeat our own efforts by doing only half the job that lies before us. The brave men whose memory we honor here did all that was required of them. They did not fail us. We must not fail them in our efforts to reach the goal for which they died. We must press on in the confidence that we will succeed in the mission a divine providence has assigned to us.
You have heard an address by President Harry S. Truman speaking at the reunion of the 35th Division Association in Little Rock, Arkansas.